sunny, breezy, and mild, a high of 47. 22 degrees tonight, 33 tomorrow. It's going to be a cold Christmas Eve and a cold Christmas Day, just a heads up. For Christmas Eve night, cloudy and cold, a low of 7 above. And then for Monday, Christmas Day, partly sunny and seasonably cold, a high of only 15. So enjoy this day. It's 40 degrees now. Coming up on 10 and a half minutes after 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start and advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. My guest today on The Morning Show, a faculty colleague from Carthage College, Dr. Yuri Maltsev, who is professor of economics at Carthage. He is part of the faculty for the renowned Clausen Center. And Professor Maltsev is joining us today on The Morning Show to help us make sense of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the tax reform bill, which is expected to be signed by President Trump very likely sometime this week. The two versions of it, the version of from the House and the version from the Senate, have been reconciled, as I think the term typically goes, and this reconciled bill now simply awaits President Trump's anticipated signature. And how this bill is going to affect the U.S. economy, how it is going to affect each of us as we pay our own taxes, how it will affect other sectors of the economy, of course, it to some extent remains to be seen, but Professor Maltsev is going to offer some expert analysis in terms of what is likely to happen. And of course, we can talk about this on a couple of different levels. One of them is very much in kind of a nuts and bolts way. There's also the matter of differences of opinion and philosophy in terms of the function of government, the function of taxes, what should be part of all that, what should not. Distribution of wealth, to what extent should that be allowed to occur as it naturally occurs, to what extent should economic policy sort of drive and direct that. There's all kinds of things we can potentially get into over the next few minutes, so we'll see where things take us. But Professor Yuri Maltsev, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Glad that you can join us. Ahead of us talking about the content of this tax reform bill, I wonder if you could offer your opinion on the process by which this has taken shape. And in particular, the criticism that has been certainly lodged by some that a whole lot of this bill has taken shape, in a sense, behind closed doors, without the collaboration that one might hope to have with something that could potentially change so much of in terms of our lives and our national economy. Did you find that at all troubling, kind of the process by which this has taken shape, or by and large, did this strike you as kind of the natural way that something like this should be done, particularly when you have one party controlling both houses of the Congress?
Well, the great Czech writer Karel Čapek, he used to say that the only thing more disgusting than looking how sausages made is to see how laws are made. and I think I completely agree with him. But this law, it has origins. I mean, if we look a little bit in the history of tax cuts, I think it goes into the tax cut, famous tax cut of 1963-1964, which was designed by an Harvard economist, Heller, who was economic advisor to JFK, to Gerald Kennedy, and which was implemented by LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, after assassination of Kennedy on the 22nd of November of 1963. And that was very bold tax cut, and it cut corporate taxes. And at that time, Kennedy said that any cut in corporate taxes would create a job, would create a salary. And that's exactly what it is. And how this tax cut was being made. I think that at first, candidate at that time, Trump, he came up with his idea of how it should look like, and I think that he proposed a 15% corporate tax rate instead of 35 or even 40%, which is which would be a real tax rate for corporations. So his first idea was pretty radical. Then it was kind of changed by the House and then by the Senate. And our elected representative, each one of them, they believe that they are very important figures, and everyone has something to say. And that's why it was looked like a breadline in Soviet Union when people were fighting for something. And then it was very interesting. For example, our Congressman Paul Ryan, he believes that instead of 20%, we should have 21%. Why would that be? Some of them would say, because we don't need such a huge budget deficit. How do we know? They are in charge of budget deficit. Whatever they vote for, that would be the budget deficit we have. Don't vote for extensive spending. So these are kind of the issues I wanted to talk about. Yeah. The most important part of this tax bill is a corporate income tax, definitely. Corporate income tax, which is planned to be 21%, makes the United States way more competitive. Some economists, even an accountant, was on the radio recently, and her point was that why not to give tax break to workers? Why do we give it to corporations? Because corporations are not taxpayers. Not many people realize that. They're tax collectors. Corporations are not people. Corporations are judicial shell in which people habitate. And so when you tax the so-called corporations, you are taxing people inside or who have a stake in this corporation. If you are a customer of Apple, you are paying Apple's corporate taxes. If you are a worker in Apple, you are paying corporate taxes for Apple.
In other words, workers and customers, in one way or another, end up bearing that cost of right now high taxation rate for corporations.
Exactly. William Randolph was chief economist of CBO, of Congressional Budget Office, in 2006. He came up with his seminal classic research Which, and he concluded that 70% of corporate income tax is paid by workers. It is paid from the wages. So this, this I think, things we should keep in mind. And then after the Reagan's tax cuts in 1983-1986, we jump started the world race to reduce corporate taxes. We have some countries, especially like Hong Kong, Singapore, Estonia, Switzerland, with almost no corporate taxes. Mm. Especially if you reinvest your profits, then you pay zero. Then you have Ireland, 12.5%. You have United Kingdom, Canada, and whatnot, all below 20%. So definitely, if you are an investor, you are interested in final returns, after tax returns, and the higher is the tax, the less attractive this country is for even talks about this corporate tax rate, that it should go down, already created a lot of interest in U.S. as an investment object. I mean, mm-hmm. Look at Foxconn, look at this German Golden Bear company here in Pleasant Prairie. It is just within 50 miles radius from this station. Mm-hmm.
And what you're saying is, even without the corporate tax rate actually going down, just serious discussion about it and the great likelihood that it will go down, that in and of itself has generated more interest in investors coming here.
Of course, because I think it signaled to businesses that this government is business friendly, and this is the most important. And then. And then people from all over the world are right now looking at the United States. And many of our, I mean, look, if you will look at say, Burger King or pharmaceutical companies, many of them put their headquarters somewhere else. Burger King right now is a Canadian company. Hmm. For what reason? Because they were scared away by this high corporate tax rates.
And do I remember from your last visit that the United States, in fact, is the highest corporate tax in the world? Does anyone else come close to our corporate tax rate?
No one does. Even the countries which are kind of, I would say, erroneously blamed as socialist countries, like Denmark or Sweden or whatnot, they have much lower tax rates. Then, if you will look, why do we have it? Because politicians erroneously also believe that corporations do not vote. Why not to tax them so much? And that was the original kind of thing, that every time when they think that they can get more, they tax corporations, and they're reducing national productivity. Because what's happening, because if capital is leaving United States, that means less capital per worker, and capital per worker is the key to productivity.
This high corporate tax rate, in your estimation, has that been a more serious issue for large corporations or for smaller, for instance, small businesses? Or are they not subject to that sky-high tax rate that you were just talking about?
Well, small business, especially if you look at sole proprietorships, then their income would be just ordinary income of the owner or owners, and so that depends on what the income is. We have highly progressive taxation in the United States. I mean, we have a situation when 50%, bottom 50% of wage earners are paying 2% of personal income tax in the United States, and 50% of upper part of taxpayers, upper half of taxpayers, are paying 98% of personal income tax, and the same is for 1%, for 5%, for 10%. So we have enough taxing success already, because what is progressive tax? Progressive tax is a tax on success. While income tax, federal income tax, is a tax on work, because 78% of all income in the United States is income from work.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Yuri Maltsev. He is professor of economics at Carthage College. He is part of the faculty of the Clausen Center. And as you can tell, we are talking right now about the much-discussed Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which has just been reconciled. That is the two versions of the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives. And this reconciled bill is expected to receive President Trump's signature sometime this week. So, Professor Maltsev, so we've spent our time right off the bat talking about what you regard as the most significant factor of this bill, namely a reduction in corporate income taxes to bring us more in line with some of our other comparable nations and perhaps making the United States a little more hospitable place. There's some other facets of the bill that are worth talking about. One of them is, first of all, the whole matter of simplifying our tax system. And that was, of course, one of the paramount campaign promises of then-candidate Trump, that he was intending to pass tax reform that would drastically simplify the process by which all of us do our taxes. If I remember correctly, there was even the idea that, you know, on a relatively small little card, you could, you know, would do everything you would need in order to kind of fill out your taxes. It appears that maybe this is a step towards that, but it does not seem like a drastically simplified tax system. Or is it? Do you see a powerful step in the right direction in terms of simplifying the tax system? And do you think that's a good thing? I mean, and if so, why? Why is that worth it to do?
Well, why? Because we have the most sophisticated IRS code. Internal Revenue Code is about 1,500 pages. And so I have a PhD in economics. I cannot do my own taxes. So this is the kind of the problems I think that we have. We're spending, according Professor Peltzman of University of Chicago, we're spending almost $600 billion in overhead costs just to pay taxes.
You mean like to pay somebody to prepare our own taxes?
That's right.
Wow.
Or spending your own time instead of doing something productive, working on your taxes, shortening your life expectancy or whatever else. So these are the is this tax bill ideal? Definitely not. But I agree with you that it is a step in the right direction. It's a step in the right direction. Why it's not ideal? Because it's still not so many transparent. It's seven income brackets for the taxes. Then what else is there? At first version, especially House version, were way more transparent and would make the bill. But then every senator would come up with something else and something else and something else. And so we have, for example, the last one was Marco Rubio, who came up with refundability of children tax credit, which is an amazing thing. The critics on the left, I think they should agree that this is an amazing thing, that people who do not pay taxes at all would get a $1,400 refund for the taxes they never paid for their children. And the more children you have, the higher will be the refund. And this refund is on the top of any other social programs that they already recipients of. So I think the itemized deductions, that was very, very sophisticated part and very complicated part of everything. Every person, I think, felt like he or she is a cheater doing this itemized deduction, because they're so ambiguous, so difficult to figure out what is deductible, what is not, and how do you need to keep this enormous amount of receipts and diaries of your pre-tax spending. Now they with the itemized deduction. With a standard deduction, which is doubled. This is amazing. Again, many people don't realize that standard deduction went up from $6,300 to $12,000. $12,000 per person, $24,000 per couple. So that means that for most people, it doesn't make any sense to go into this itemized deduction jungle and try to navigate there nicely. So this is the major simplification of that, and this is very generous.
Right. So for the typical person and the typical couple, it will not make sense to go into the whole itemized deduction business. And so, even if that complicated system is largely in place, most of us won't have to dive into that. We can just do the simple standard deduction, and that will suffice.
And simplify
our lives.
Right. I can just give an example. Because I'm doing a lot of public speaking and doing a lot of traveling for conferences, so all the time I'm delaying traffic, for example, on the toll roads by asking for a receipt for a toll. So the toll is $1.50, but I need to get this receipt. Now I wouldn't need to do that. It will be just a standard deduction. I don't need these shoeboxes with with old yellow receipts.
Very good. So this is one certainly potential positive. Let's get to the matter of whose taxes are actually cut. That is, what citizens in general will be paying lower taxes. And it appears I'm looking at something from the Tax Policy Center, which is a nonpartisan or let's say bipartisan organization that has done analysis, and they find that the bill, as it currently stands, would reduce taxes on average for all income groups in both 2018 and 2025, with the largest tax cuts going to the very highest income earners. Up in the upper 90 percentiles. And, of course, some of the tax cuts, particularly for the lower economic classes, will start to go down over the course of time. What is your analysis of who is going to pay fewer taxes, and do you think it makes sense where that tax relief has been placed? And of course, the big million-dollar question is, does it make economic sense for the wealthiest Americans to be receiving the most tax relief?
One thing, I don't know how bipartisan or nonpartisan this is, tax foundation. But from another hand, if you will look, the richest Americans, they get tax relief in the amount of 2.5%, right? 2.5%. So because the upper tax break is from 13. Went down from 39% to 37.5%. However, many of them definitely would be slapped with more taxes unexpectedly, and this would be the taxes that they cannot write off, either real estate taxes or state income taxes in the high. Most, if you will look where our billionaires and multimillionaires live, they live in the high tax states like New York, like California, like New Jersey, Massachusetts, and many and some others. So then they would not be able to write off their huge palaces, their huge residences, their real estate holdings from the federal income tax, and some people, they believe, some economists even think that that was pretty partisan decision because the states also vote for Democrats all the time. So then, kind of. But from another hand, the rationale, I think, behind this new tax bill, that why these deductions would not be eligible anymore, because why people in the low tax states should pay should subsidize people in a high tax states, because maybe in the high tax states they have maybe better roads, better social services, better this and that, and why the whole country which does not enjoy these things.
Mm. That's an interesting perspective. I'd seen that somebody had done sort of an analysis of a person who makes, let's say, $1 million a year. If they live in such and such a state, they are likely going to be paying this amount. If they live in this state, their total tax bill would be this amount. And and the blue states versus red states, there was quite a dramatic difference. But you see that as actually from your perspective as a fair way to do it. Actually,
I think it is. I believe it is, because then. The people, the people who are voting for politicians, are big spenders in the high tax states. They will think twice from this point on, because what does it mean that if I'm paying my my taxes on and deducting other taxes from, then you don't know who's in charge. Is it federal government or federal income tax, or there's a local governments which would put an assessment on my road or assessment on something else. So this I think makes it both more transparent, easier to do because one of deductions goes, and the previous version, definitely the House version, that it should go away completely. Now again, as a compromise, it's $10,000 cap. $10,000 cap, that means if your property taxes are below $10,000, then you can still deduct them from federal income tax. So that definitely for the brokes like me, it makes the world of difference. But say for Mr. Trump, who has this billion-dollar worth properties in New York and California and Illinois and in New Jersey, then for him, definitely, that would be kind of a very serious increase in his tax liability.
Hmm. That's interesting. You're pointing to something that has been said by some that President Trump concocted all of this just for the sake of lowering his own taxes and the taxes of his buddies who are in the same tax bracket. And what you are suggesting is that, in fact, it may be a very different reality, and that, in fact, the final tax bill that President Trump could pay might ultimately be actually higher than it is now.
Yes. Well,
at least comparable.
Yes. Well, his tax return looks like they're kind of a national secret, so we don't know what's in. But from another hand, I think that his tax rate will go from 39% to 37.5%, because he probably is in the upper bracket. From another hand, he would not enjoy the reduction of corporate income tax because he doesn't have corporations. Trump Organization, which is his real estate company, is a partnership between him and his family. So they will be still taxed as their ordinary income. So that looks like 37.5%. From another hand, he would not be able to write off his income tax in New York as well as property taxes in all the states he has these properties, which will be capped for $10,000, which probably for him, $10,000 is the same as a quarter for me.
So, in other words, because the Trump Organization, technically speaking, is not a corporation, in fact, the Trump Organization does not directly benefit from this lowering of the corporate tax rate.
Yes. They have some the so-called bypass businesses amendments, but they have also caps there of about $350,000. So it's that's kind of like peanuts in this in this world.
One of the concerns of some is the way in which certain provisions of this bill are ultimately going to hurt things like certain entitlements that many people depend on, like Social Security and Medicare and so on. Do you share any of those concerns, or do you think those concerns are largely unfounded?
I don't think that this bill would do much to Medicare or Medicaid. This bill would do quite a lot to Affordable Care Act, to Obamacare, so-called, because then you wouldn't need to buy insurance. You won't be penalized for that. It's only the tax part of it, because Affordable Care Act is it's not only about care; it's also about taxing, and so then the people would not be obliged to buy this insurance, and so they predict that about 13 million people would get off Affordable Care Act.
Certain things that were stripped out of the bill that were in earlier versions are some things that were of concern, like taxation of graduate students, tuition, deductibility of student loan interests, different matters like that. It sounds like you were probably not surprised that some of those things that potentially could be quite unpopular have been stripped away from this bill. Do you think it's a good thing that they were stripped away, or do you think some of those original provisions should have been left in place?
Well, why the House wanted to discontinue deduction for the graduate students' grants. Because they thought that this group of people, when they will get the degree they desire, then they would be one of the highest earners in the country. And why should people who are much poorer than them pay for that? So that was the rationale. I think that graduate work, because if you will look who is doing most of the scientific research in the United States, there's some stars, Nobel laureates, but mostly it's done by graduate students. Mm. And I think if we want to kind of promote this research, then I don't strongly disagree with the Senate amendment that this should go away. So there's no extra taxes on graduate students in this bill.
What about the matter, we've danced around it, but let's tackle it head on, the matter of who is given tax relief and the fact that it is the very top of the income levels that appear to receive the most tax benefit. Does that make economic sense to you?
Well, I don't see it this way. I mean, the tax rate from 39% to 37.5% reduction definitely will benefit the people in the 1% or 5% bracket. But from another hand, we have, I think, enough of this progressivism in our taxation. So because if you will look who is paying what, you will see that 10% of taxpayers are paying over 50% of taxes already. So if you have right now 7 million Americans are living overseas, most of them for tax purposes. So if you have people who are immigrating because of the tax bills, so they're taking away their capital, they're employing people somewhere else, they're contributing to the economies of their new homes rather than contributing to this economy. So I don't see much of this, that this tax, especially with all these amendments, which were put later, that it kind of especially promotes the rich. It promotes the rich definitely in the sense that because the rich pay all these taxes, so tax cuts would not apply to people who do not pay taxes, and right. That's almost half of the population of the United States. So this is, but to help these people, we have Rubio Amendment, which is $1,400 per child, refundable. That means it's not just they would return the taxes you already were taken from your paycheck, but it's just getting there from the Internal Revenue Service.
Right. In other words, I think what you're saying is it's almost inevitable that if you are going to be serious about cutting taxes, that the sector of the population who is paying the most tax are likely to receive most of that benefit. I mean, it makes mathematical sense.
Right. And it leads to more capital per worker. And again, more capital per worker because it will all be, I mean, all the money saved from taxation, they would be saved. If they would be saved, our banking institutions would convert them to investments. So investments would lead to increase in capital per worker. Increase in the capital per worker is the key to wealth of the country, is the key to the prosperity of all, is the key to workers' productivity. And productivity is the key to success. And, say, corporate income tax was the tax on productivity.
And so it's little wonder then in your estimation that that's why productivity has been hurt.
Yes.
Because it's been taxed.
Exactly.
At what you would say is an unfair rate. Mm-hmm. One of the labels that this kind of tax relief is sometimes given is trickle-down economics, mm-hmm. that you give this benefit to those at the very top of the income scale and then they are likely then to turn around and take that money and do things with it that will be of benefit to those that are below them in the lower economic layers. First of all, I wonder what you think of that term, because it's probably a term that is crafted not as a compliment. I mean, trickling makes it seem like something fairly negligible that's likely to happen in terms of good things for the rest of the economy. So first of all, I wonder if you even think that's a valid term or a term you're comfortable with. And also, does that term apply here to this particular tax reform bill?
Yes, the trickle down, this word trickle is kind of tricky. But from another hand, if you will look at Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, he is kind of the author of this theory. That his point is that the big tide will lift all the boats, big and small. And this is what economic growth does to people. So this is the most important thing for us to keep in mind. About trickling down, if you will look at the role, economic role of rich people in society, in the United States, we have a lot of anti-capitalist mentality spreading around already for the last maybe 30, 40 years. And this is very sad, because this anti-capitalist mentality is based on social envy mostly. And social envy never helped anyone, any country, to achieve. Some countries were completely destroyed by this social envy. And right now is 100th anniversary of this dreadful revolution in Soviet Union, in Russia, which ended in mass murder and economic decay and complete absence of any human and civil rights there. So from that perspective, we also should look at another role, which nobody kind of looks at it, especially in mass media, the role of rich people in promoting innovation. If you will look at everything, you look at my watch, you look at computer, look at everything around you, it first emerged as a luxury good. It first emerged that only rich people could buy it. The first digital watch was about $400. And who would buy that? Yes. So then everything, I mean, just even simple things like shoes and socks and whatever, they all emerged as luxury goods. And that's what many people don't want to notice. And then besides that, what the rich people are doing with this money, personal consumption of the rich in the United States is estimated 4% of gross domestic product. 4%, so we're paying 4% for this great yachts or whatever they have, but for that they created, I mean, not they created, but they're part of economic system which benefits everybody. Because if you will look even at our poor people or people who do not pay taxes, they still, if you will look from the global perspective, they're within 4% of the wealthiest people on this planet. So this is the kind of the very, I was teaching classes on poverty and income distribution. And it's very interesting that many people, for example, hate corporations, hate, say, Walmart, whatever. But if it's a mutually beneficial exchange, and these are the exchanges, because they're voluntary exchanges. And so that's I think, this hatred is misplaced. Yeah. And that's, I think, the with this tax bill, there's a good saying that among economists that any tax cut for any amount, for any reason, or with no reason at all, is a great thing to have.
Interesting. Of course, one mathematical reality is that this, at least at the moment, this tax relief package also adds considerably to our debt, to the tune of, I think, about $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. So first of all, do you see that as a potential harm? Or is that not especially significant?
Yes, this is, I think, is something called voodoo economics. $1 trillion. Well, one thing, during the last 8 years, we doubled our national debt by $10 trillion. So now we have $1 trillion in 10 years. It's in 10 years. Besides that, who can know this? I mean, this is. This $1 trillion, I can come up with a number, $5 trillion or or surplus, but nobody knows. How would we know how the Congress would allocate our spending? This is yes.
I see. So in other words, this figure is somebody's estimate, and it's impossible to know at this point exactly how much all of this is going to add to our debt.
Right, because it's based on ceteris paribus, as economists would say, perception. That means ceteris paribus, that everything else is kept equal. But it is it doesn't have any meaning, this $1 trillion, can be more, can be less, can be whatever. It reminds me, my first job was in the Soviet Department of Labor, and my boss was talking about statistics of working conditions. And one gentleman, he said, how you can come up with this? There's no primary reporting on that. He said, well, you look at the ceiling, and then you see numbers, take them down, go to the boss, and he will correct you. And then this poor person, he said, I don't see anything. He said, well, have another drink. So this is, a lot of these statistics. It was just amazing that statistics is deteriorating in the United States. That's very sad. Statistics is becoming more as opinion rather than statistics, than a hard science.
Right. I would love to. We don't have a whole lot of time left. I would like to return to the point that you were making about social envy. Explain that term to our listeners. What exactly does it mean when someone demonstrates social envy? I think I know what you're getting at, but I want to know more clearly. And then the way in which that social envy plays into what you see as some form of socialism, which I know is a concern that you express quite often, that you have seen the United States, at least in some respects, moving in this direction. And to what extent are those two things tied together, social envy and us moving to something that, in your mind at least, represents or resembles socialism?
Yes, well, this is the essence of Marxism. Karl Marx, his slogan was abolish the private property, number one, and the second is expropriate expropriators. So if you have private property, kind of, if you are richer than others, that means, according to Marx and Lenin and Mao Zedong and whomever else, that means that you have stolen this property from somebody else. That private property is theft. That's Proudhon, I think, the French socialist, 19th century, used to say. So that from that perspective, that it looks like everybody's entitled for exactly the same thing. But people don't realize that this equality can be achieved only in dire poverty. So this is the we've been in Cuba with my students. And I was blessed that Deirdre McCloskey, a professor from University of Illinois in Chicago, very famous economist, she was Donald McCloskey, if somebody remembers his books. Yeah, so 28 books between Donald and Deirdre. And we went to a collective farm there. And in a collective farm, farm chairwoman was saying that we have a real paradise here. We have a free healthcare, free education, almost free housing, free food. And then Deirdre said, well, can you move out? And she said, why would you move out? And she said, well, maybe I am crazy. I just don't want to be here. And said, of course you cannot move out. And Deirdre, appealing to my students, said, what kind of economic system is that? You have everything for free, but you cannot move. And one student immediately said, slavery. And that is slavery. Only in slavery you can have total equality. And then because people are unequal in their ambitions, in their skills, in their productivity, in their goals in life. And so that's why if you want to make them everybody equal, then you will have the lowest equal denominator possible. So, and this is very sad to see for me, especially from the country I came from, where 60 million people were slaughtered, to see people in the United States again embracing this deadly society. For example, we have a lot of this people promoting the idea that inequality, that we have this drastic inequality, this awful inequality. And what is social envy? That means that even I feel myself comfortable, whatever, but you have something more, then I should hate you. But economics is not a zero-sum game. Economics is all the time based on voluntary transactions. I'm doing this because I like it. And because of that, everybody benefits. That means that the richer the society is, the better it is. And the more rich people will have, the better it is for everybody. And so that's the if you have wealthy, nice neighborhoods, that's why we subsidize education, for example, to have more incomes and whatnot. And most, if you will look at the richest people right now in the United States, most of them being, they were produced by IT revolution, that internet technology. If you look, people like Bezos, for example, Gates, they made themselves from absolute scratch. I mean, they didn't inherit billions. And so they, but if you will just remember, when I came to Kenosha in 1991, if I need to travel, I would go to a travel agent. Now there are not many of them left. And now you just go to Travelocity or Expedia or whatever, buy yourself a ticket and go anywhere you like. And for many people in the beginning, it was kind of they thought how awful it is. And many travel agents tried to stop this kind of thing by decertifying this website, so things like that. But many people remember how idiotic the whole idea that you should fill your own gas tank without the help of attendant. And that's, yeah, so this is, or many people don't remember that in 1900, 80% of people worked in agriculture. And we had a huge campaign against to support family farms. Can you imagine if now 80% of people would be working in the UK, we would be the poorest country in the world.
Right. So in other words, change is something that we should not fear. Change is something we should not jump to conclusions about, that at least in many, many cases, change is ultimately for the better.
Well, yes, both. Aldous Huxley in his Brave New World, I think he warned us that from another hand, we should be pretty much aware of a big brother, of a big government, which can use all these things. And because, look, all these hackers, all these intrusions on privacy, all the so-called macro data collections by NSA, no such agency, they call it. So that's what is worrying me, not that some people will be richer than others.
Interesting. Well, on that unsettling note, I think we have to draw this conversation to a close, but I certainly appreciate the perspective that you have shared with us on this very, very important legislation and what it could potentially mean for us individually and for us collectively as a country as we move forward from here into the new year. Dr. Yuri Maltsev, Professor of Economics, I always enjoy the opportunity to have you here on the morning show, and I appreciate you very much making time for this during finals week at Carthage, a busy time for all of us. I really appreciate you being my guest today, and I look forward to having you back.
Oh, thank you.
Good to have you here. We want to remind you that the morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Tomorrow on the morning show, my guest will be Harlow Giles Unger. He is a prolific historian and writer of historical biographies, and his most recent book is called The First Founding Father, Richard Henry Lee and the Call to Independence. Richard Henry Lee, an ancestor actually of Robert E. Lee, was one of the first Americans to speak out boldly and clearly for the cause of American independence from Great Britain. And we talk with Mr. Unger tomorrow about his biography of Richard Henry Lee. On Thursday, we're going to tell you why you have to avoid sugar. My guest is Gary Taubes, and his book is called The Case Against Sugar, Bad News in This Holiday Season, of course. On Friday, my guest is Ransom Akasha, who is executive director of the Hazelton Betty Ford facility in Chicago. Pardon me, I think actually we're airing that interview tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken. At any rate, that interview will talk about the way in which those who are struggling with addiction can find this time of year to be especially difficult. And the conversation is about ways in which we, as we extend hospitality during the holidays, can maybe do so